This is Authors in Focus.
Hi, I'm James Reed, a fantasy author publishing under JMD Reed. My first series, The Storm Below, is now out as a full box set. Today, I'm joined by Christopher Fink. He's the author of Kin.
How are you doing today, Christopher?
I'm doing very well today, sir, James. How are you?
I'm doing good, doing good. You know, it's raining here, so that's kind of typical where I live.
Yeah. By me, it's it's a little warmer than normal, which is good. I can hold off the harsh winter weather as long as possible. That's fine by me.
Yes, we don't really get harsh winter weather. We get a mild cold. Maybe it'll get into the 30s at night. That's about good. The worst of it. You know, sometimes it can get pretty cold, but it's very rare. And then we all freak out because no one knows how to handle it. So I always like to start the interview out with a fun question. So, Chris, what is your favorite color?
I would have to say purple.
Purple. Very interesting color. The royal purple, huh?
Yes, that's exactly it. It's very strong in nature.
Yeah. It all came from these little seashells in the Mediterranean that were very rare and made purple dye. And that's why purple is royalty, because it was the rarest of dyes.
Oh, yeah. Interesting.
So it was the most expensive dye. Yep, that's why purple is associated with royalty. It goes all the way back to, like, ancient Greece.
No kidding.
Yep. So, like, if you want to show you had money, you had something that was purple. It's the same reason high heels were invented. So, like, you can show, like, how lazy you are because you're so rich, you can wear uncomfortable shoes all day. Because you don't have to walk around. I'm not joking. You should look at the shoes of, like, the French court in, like, the 1600s. And they're worn by men, too. So that's where high heels started.
Yeah, true.
Yeah, that's always fun. So, like, yeah, no, you know, when you're... That's how you used to show your wealth. You were like, I'm so lazy, I can, you know, wear uncomfortable footwear because I don't have to walk a lot because I'm that wealthy. While you little peons have to work all day in the fields wearing more comfortable shoes. So, Chris, how long have you wanted to be an author?
How long?
For how long? When did that bug first bite?
I started off with wanting to explore screenwriting. And shortly thereafter, I went to New York Film Academy for that. And got a few scripts under my belt that I've written. Nothing's really moved yet because I didn't know at the time how difficult an industry that was. Or at least I should say I didn't respect how difficult it was. But one of the more common lessons I've learned was don't get married to your work. Don't, whatever you write, don't hold it to heart, because if it does go somewhere, it's going to get torn to pieces more than likely. And after the script writing, I tried my hand at a few short stories and I said, I wanted to see if I have the patience to actually produce a full book of a collection of them. And that started, I'd say, about 6-7 years ago at a point where I didn't really know what I was going to do with them yet. So I just decided to start writing and see what it's all like.
Yeah, people always ask me, like, hey, who would you like to play your character in the movie? And I'm like, no one, because I don't want Hollywood to adapt my stuff because it's too personal to me. And they would just ruin it. Yeah. So...
Yeah.
Although, I mean, it's easy to say an abstract, you know, because it's, like, never happening. Because I'm, like, some indie nobody. And who knows, like, when they give you that check and you're like, oh, that's a lot of zeros. That could really change things.
I was going to say, I don't know. I'm to think, to be that optimistic and think that far ahead, I like to feel that I'd have at least an argument to bring to the table as far as, you know, a say in the matter as to how you're going to treat my work. Because, after all, it's my work.
You would say that, but you could talk to Rick Riordan about how well they respected his work when they made The Lightning Thief.
Yeah, I know he's not the only one that they take all kinds of liberties to.
Yeah, like, you got to be a rare author. You got to be like J.K. Rowling, who, like, you know, was like, no, I'm going to approve things.
Yeah.
I'm going to choose the script writer and I'm going to, like, hover over their head because my books are just that much popular that you have to deal with me. Like...
Exactly. Once you gain enough clout with the audience, then that they know you just as well as they know the filmmakers.
Yeah, she was very good at preserving her rights on her works, I will have to say. Whatever else your opinions about her, she made sure she had, like, all the digital rights and, you know, everything. She didn't let them take much from her.
Yeah, well, that's good. Smart.
So... Let's talk about you and your writing and not J.K. Rowling, because she doesn't need people to talk about her books because everyone knows who she is. So you just got your novel out. It's Kin, Russ?
Yes, correct.
That's spelled K-Y-N, but I think we can all sort of get what it's it sounds like. I'm blanking on what that English word is for a word that sounds the same. Homophone, that's it. So anyways, lichens in your world are on the decline, and Darius Ashwin, he just wants to live a normal life, but can he stay on the sidelines in the coming conflict? Let's talk about it. Tell us about your book. Tell us about Darius.
It's pronounced Darius. Okay. A little slight difference there.
That's fine.
He is the last remaining, or one of the last remaining of a great bloodline of lichen. And throughout the centuries have continually dwindled in numbers, but in their current standing, they are few and far between. And as a result, he has just taken on a life of, for lack of a better word, domestication, and has sat comfortably with that, you know, for his, you know, for his existence, in that he's got a wife, daughter, a house in, you know, in the country that's off the beaten path. And, you know, basically lives a humble lifestyle with this burden, I guess you'd say, over his shoulder, in that he, you know, is in fact a lichen. And only in recent time, over the last year or so, has the possibility began to cross his mind as to whether or not his daughter has inherited that trait, because he's married to a human woman.
Okay. Is this in our world or like a fantasy world?
Oh, no, it's our world.
Okay, just wanted to get that clear.
Yeah.
Usually you go like, you know, lichens is probably our world, but I've met some authors, you know, that they throw them in their fantasy worlds. So.
No, it exists in, you know, today's world in upstate New York.
Ah, okay. Fair enough. There's a lot of urban fantasies I've been hearing about from upstate New York.
Yeah, my grandfather has a cabin up there, so having visited the area a number of times, it seemed like the perfect setting.
Is that like where the Catskill Mountains are?
Yes.
All right, yeah, I'm on the West Coast, so like we just hear about these places that are called mountains, and I definitely put air quotes over those. They look like baby hills.
Well, it depends on where in the West Coast. I visited Washington recently, and they're anything but, you know, flat terrains.
Yeah, no, I'm in Washington. I can look out my window, and if it wasn't overcast, I would stare at, like, Mount Rainier towering over me.
So, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so I grew up looking at that every day. In fact, I don't know. I don't know if you ever read The Mallorian by David Eddings.
No.
Okay, well, he has this giant mountain in it that, like, he describes as, like, it looms over everything, and it just, like, you see it for, like, days or weeks of traveling. And I'm like, yeah, he grew up here, so he definitely knows what that's like. But there's just this mountain that dominates the skyline that you can see from, you know, Olympia to Seattle, which is, you know, it's like a two-hour drive on the freeway
between
those places. You'll see it. Yeah, you can see it almost everywhere in the Pacific Northwest or in Western Washington. All right, that's cool. So Darius, he doesn't want to get involved. I get it. He's got a wife, kids. But someone whose name I did write down in my notes is wanting to start trouble. Is that correct?
Yes. His name is Clay.
Clay, that's it. Yeah. So just sort of tell us kind of what's sort of the inciting incident. How does the story get going? And what makes it such a compelling read for the listeners to want to, you know, give it a try?
Well, once I have people interested in the book, I always leave it ambiguous enough where there's definitely a story to be told beforehand and one to continue afterwards. At least that's how I always write my stuff. Nothing's ever tied up in a bow at the end or at the beginning. It just kind of drops you in the middle of what's going on.
Okay.
But Clay's story is one of kind of like his whole life has been lying in wait, and I say life as in centuries old, because he is one that has been afflicted with the curse of the Wendigo, and in his time he had succumbed to starvation and basically just fed on his own kind. Anyone that's familiar with with the story of the Wendigo knows that was a story told by Native Americans as in an effort to, you know, deter cannibalism.
Yeah, it's the Algonquin, I believe, is where the Wendigo comes from, specifically. Yes. But I think the other tribes have their own kind of versions of it. But yeah, they're up there in that sort of New York, Canada area.
The whole New England area, yep.
Yeah, yeah.
But he is the only one left that was alive in the days of the what I call the Great Siege of his people's castle. And as a result, you know, him and his people were run out and left, you know, basically left to go roam the woods for however long they decided to live, or however long they could survive, I should say. And, yeah, that's what he ended up doing as a result, was basically feeding on one of his own kind. And unbeknownst to them, that was the result of which, that he was cursed with this. And in addition to it being, you know, an affliction, it's an alteration of his, like a lichen will change once a month for the, you know, lunar cycles. Whereas the Wendigo I have in my story changes every time he's hungry enough. And in addition to lives forever with that. So basically he was around in a time when they were basically reigning over humanity. And after everything had happened, he was forced to live out throughout the centuries, just watching, you know, the demise of his people, his numbers falling, and basically having to endure that sight and that existence. But his vision now was to find somebody that he could manipulate and convince to see his ways. And he found that in Darce's daughter. Because because somebody like Darce is too old and too set in his ways to be convinced otherwise.
Gotcha.
He was born into this lifestyle, so he's basically can't be shown anything else. But his daughter, as young as she is, can be influenced, can be swayed, can be convinced otherwise before she knows what, you know, life is like. He can tell her, you know, you were meant for more than this. You know, this is where our resurgence begins, and it starts with you.
Gotcha. Cool. Well, so where did you get the idea for writing about a lichen that becomes a Wendigo, and just sort of this whole idea? Where did it sort of spark from?
It started from a simple car ride. One day I was driving with a friend and happened to be down a really dark a dark roadway by, you know, where I live now. And around me is a lot of wooded areas. So I just happened to be looking into the woods and just thought to myself, you know, what could possibly be out there looking back at me, if anything. And from there, it's the way my story, my creative process works, is if something is intriguing, I'll tack another idea onto it and so on and so forth until I hit a wall. If I do that, then I'll just start from scratch whenever. But a lot of times I don't try to come up with a story. I just let flow whatever ideas come and go. And my favorite cryptid monster / old movie monster is a werewolf. So I just took that with that notion and I ran with that. And I thought to myself that they never really have gotten center stage. They've always played second fiddle to, vampires and anything else. They've always been, on the sidelines, or at least the sidekick. I wanted to give the Lycans, front stage, their own story by themselves. And from there, I just thought, all right, well, what if this was the case? What if they did exist, but there weren't that many. That's why they're seen, but never really proven. And I just added the story of they used to be this tyrannical reign over medieval villages. They lived in castles up on on mountainsides. And then from there, I just let my ideas flow. And I got to a point where I thought I had too much to throw away. And I just decided to piece it together one day.
Cool. All right. That sounds like a really, nice idea to just sort of build it up. I know that's kind of how, I kind of get an idea for like a story, just like a maybe like a character beat or something. And it's like, that's really cool, but I don't know what the story it's going to be in. And then I'll be like, I want to tell this sort of story. And I'm like, well, I have this idea, another idea. I could just throw it in there, you know, because it'll fit here.
Yep. Yeah, a lot of my stuff, I plan basically beat points, but I don't necessarily have a full outline whenever I'm working on any given project, not just this one, because I don't know if anything is going to either come to me in the process of writing it, in which case I'd want the room to be able to, you know, insert it in there, or if I have a better idea of what the ending might be, which in this case I did for this book. That's exactly what happened. I sort of had an ending in mind, and only so far through I come up with something that I thought was better, and I ended up scrapping it at the last second. So the way it was fortunate too, because all the way through, about for 2/3 of the book, even more, I had written with the thought of having my original ending in place. And only until the last minute did I come up with a different idea that I thought was, you know, leaps and bounds better. And I decided to run with that. So I feel like that helped in the matter of not hinting at anything, not hinting the ending at all, because that was not my idea to begin with. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I know. Sometimes you just can't make your original ending work. Like, you know, it's the logistics behind it don't make sense. Yeah. Like you thought it would. I had that happen. I was like, I wanted to have this ending where in the earlier part of the novel, they're being hunted by this sort of like almost like a Terminator-esque character, where like it's like this big brute that's been magically enhanced, and it like it's they can't kill it, they can't defeat it. All they can do is like delay it, or you know, this, you know, drop it off a cliff or something. But it, you know, that's not going to kill it. So this is what they did. They dropped it. They destroyed like the bridge beneath it, and it fell into a river. And that's how they got away. And I was like, okay. And I wanted him to jump them, like in this sort of dungeon at the end when they're going to rescue someone from a prison cell. And then I got to it, and I'm just like, how does this guy find them in the prison cell? Like, he's a brute. He's not a thinker, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, they really did lose him. They got like days on him. Like, and they're in the city where they're thieves. They're really good at not being noticed. So I'm like, how does he find them? Like, so I was like, I couldn't even like get him to ambush them anywhere in the city, because I couldn't get the logic to how does this guy ever find them, because, you know, he isn't like chasing them in the countryside where he like knew where they left and was dispatched, you know, because they had a break out of this place. So like they lost him. Now they're in the city. They're in their city. Where they know it, where they're like a group of thieves, you know, this is what they do. Like, there's no way this guy who basically is just like an, you know, a robot. Like, he's not an intelligent being. He's just a brute. He's the guy you don't want to run into. You know, you don't want to fight this guy. You just want to. So, like, it didn't work. And I was so annoyed. And I'm like, and I'm sitting here going, like, I don't have like a climax any longer. And I'm like, I don't know what to do. So I'm just like, all right. I was like, all right. I'm just gonna resolve this like love triangle part, and then as I'm resolving the love triangle, I found my climax in a very surprising way, where it turned out like a lot of pieces on this sort of character clicked in my head, and I'm like, oh, he's not gonna take being told no well, and so it provided my climax. I was really like worried. I was like, great. The fourth book of my 5-book series doesn't have an ending. I don't know what to do about that.
That's good, though. I mean, like I said, a lot of my stuff I like to leave open-ended. It's good to, you know, come to a point with all your characters, but I don't like having a completed story, if that makes any sense, only because it should be an experience for the reader as well as the author.
Right. I wasn't saying I wanted like a completed story. I wanted to end the book on something more than, and then the book's over. Like,
yeah.
To have something to have like it, you know, to have like, you know, it's a fantasy book with a lot of action. So I wanted to have like, you know, something, you know, meaningful there instead of they, I mean, my, like, the, because the prison break was really easy. It was, because I never intended it to be, because I intended him to jump them in there, so that was going to be where that challenge was. And then when I realized that didn't work, it, you know, I was like, maybe I can have him jump in the street, but I couldn't get that to work. So it's like the prison break, there was no real, like, difficulty in it. Like, it went very smoothly for them, you know, because that was kind of the point. It was supposed to go smoothly and then go wrong, but then it didn't, so... that I was scrambling to figure out how to fix it. But, I found it there in the end. And then it worked well because it gave, like, my character something emotional, like an emotional arc she had to deal with in the next book. So it gave me something meaty to have her do. Because, like, her arc had been, like, because her arc in the series is pretty much done at this point. So she was kind of, like, a completed character by the time we get to the final novel if I didn't have this take place to kind of give her something to work on emotionally. Because of what she was kind of doing in book four was kind of like the ultimate part of that sort of completion, and there was other characters that had kind of arcs going into the final novel, but like she didn't really have one because like it just how the story was structured. So it's, you know, so it worked out well for the best. So are you working on a sequel to Kin, or is it a standalone?
I wanted to write it in the sense that it can be its own story by itself, but I did so also with the intention of I wanted to write a prequel to it, and that has been a big consensus with a lot of people that have read it so far. They've asked, you know, they said this story is great, but they wanted to know more about what had happened, what had led up to this point, and I said, well, and I was kind of glad to hear that because that was an idea that I just kind of have on the shelf right now, is to write a prequel of what had happened, you know, all those centuries ago.
Okay.
Like a story that would start with, you know, seeing their lives as they were in their most dominant time, and basically carrying on to what had happened and their existence back in the woods type thing.
Cool. All right. Well, Chris, if you want to let our readers know where they can sort of connect with you on like social media.
Yeah. Anyone, that's interested, can find me under my handle name is The Horror Seeker, and that's all over, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. I'm working on my website right now. It's not up yet, but it will be soon. But, all of my content goes under that name, and not just my author content, but I content creator, and I have articles that I'm writing. I'm trying to focus it on my own entity because I've participated on several other websites for just freelance work that just to get some circulation going. But right now, I think I've reached a point where my handle can be strong enough to stand on its own. So anyone that's looking, just look up The Horror Seeker, and I picked a unique enough name just by sheer luck because I haven't found anything that comes remotely close.
Awesome. Well, it was really great talking with you, Chris.
Well, you too. Thank you very much.
You have a good one.
You too. Have a good one.
This has been Authors in Focus. You can find my fantasy novels on Amazon. Follow news of my writing at my blog, jmd-read.com, and follow me on Twitter at jmdread. You can also join my reader group on Facebook, Fantastical Worlds of the Imagination. You can find more episodes of the podcast at fantasy-focus.com and wherever your favorite podcast is hosted.